Andy Warhol looks and screams at him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland, the show where artists meet and talk about their work. This week, I went to the opening of At This Time, which is the BFA and MFA degree show for Portland State University. The show is on two floors at the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art on Broadway, and is open to the public. On Thursday, the place was filled with artists, many of them showing off their work and talking about it, and their friends and a few proud family members too. I spoke to one professor and five artists, who are all very patient and eloquent. It's a show well worth visiting if you want to see what media are popular right now. There was some painting, but much more sculpture, multimedia and installation art, and social practice art, which is a specialty of Portland State. I spoke to Julie Perini, professor in the School of Art and Design, who also teaches video and time-based art, and five artists, Ash Brazel, Madeline Blackham, Alejandro Ponce, Laura Glazer, and Kiara Wells. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. Before we move on to the interviews, I want to remind you that KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform. That means we are funded by you, the listener. If you're a regular listener of Art Focus, and I know I have at least five, or you just enjoy the program, please show your support for the station by making a contribution today, or better yet, become a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text the letters KBOO to the number 44321. Now on with the show.
My name is Julie Perini. That's spelled J-U-L-I-E, and then P as in Peter, E-R-I-N-I. And I am the coordinator of our BFA in Art Practice program, and I'm a professor here in the School of Art and Design, where I teach video and time-based art here at Portland State University.
So we're in the basement of the Jordan Schnitzer, and what do we see?
Well, this is the opening reception for our BFA in Art Practice program. We have an interdisciplinary art program here, so students are showing work that is in painting and drawing, in sculpture, in textile arts, in media arts, in social practice art, and all everything in between, a big mix of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So these are students who are just getting their BFA this month?
Yes, yes. The graduation is in 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. These are students getting their undergraduate degree, their Bachelor of Fine Arts from Portland State University's School of Art and Design, yes.
Is their degree based on this show? How much of this show goes towards their degree?
Yeah. The students take, for the first few years, they take classes throughout the school in all kinds of media, and then they spend their final almost year and a half almost working on this thesis project. So in their third year, they take a class where they propose the project, where they come up with an idea and research it. And they spend the entire final year taking a class every quarter where they're working on creating the thesis. And then this term, they work on exhibiting the thesis, which is its own project. You know, they learn about how to write an artist statement, how to write a project statement, all the kind of stuff that goes with gallery and museum exhibition like you're seeing, putting text on the wall, figuring out how do you display all these different kinds of artwork. I mean, that in itself is a whole class, you know. You see art on shelves, art on pedestals, art on dress forms, art that's interactive, you know. And so all that happens in our program in the last year. Yeah, it's a big part of the program. They need to do this to graduate from our BFA, to have a public show and to speak about it publicly too.
Oh, they speak as well?
Yeah, yeah. This week and next week, we are doing a series of artist talks where the students stand with their artwork and kind of give us an in-depth explanation and description of their process and the thinking around it and other artists they resonate with and the history of this medium. Whatever it is that they want to talk about, they share that with an audience publicly here. And then we ask questions and we're putting it on Zoom too, so people come from all over. A lot of students invite their families who are in different parts of the country or world even.
So an artist may have 2 years to put on a gallery show and maybe produce 20 paintings for a commercial gallery. Here, they have basically a year and a bit to produce. How much, what's the quantity?
Right. Well, they just have to produce a body of work, whatever that means to the medium they're working in. So what you're seeing here usually is not everything they made for their thesis. Because they're in a group show here, they have to edit down, you know, like many of these garment makers, like this one here, Nadia.
Who is this?
Nadia Belov. She made 3 or 4 times the amount of work we're seeing here. She is very prolific. And but, you know, for the show, in order to share space with all the other artists, everyone had to edit down, which is a really good skill to learn, too. How do you participate in group exhibitions and things like that? Yeah.
My name is Ash Brazel, A-S-H, and then B-R-A-Z-E-L-L. I'm getting my Bachelor of Fine Arts from Portland State University in summer 2023. And my project that is here is called Unsaid Words. It's a socially engaged portrait project in which I met up with 20 different people and asked them to talk to me about the circumstances surrounding words that had gone unsaid for them in their life. And then I photographed them while we were together, and I used those as to do paintings. So then I did 20 large-scale paintings in watercolor and ink, and then we mixed up the words between the faces to allow a layer of anonymity between the subjects, because some of the things that people said, they didn't want the world to know that they had said them. Mm-hmm. So that's why we kind of switched up the words. And then there's a mirror in the center to invite the viewer to be involved in it, as well as an interactive feature on the side for people to write their own unsaid words and submit them into the box.
So these are colored portraits, watercolor and paint on paper, very vivid colors, very centrally located on white.
Yes.
You've allowed the paint to drip in places, but generally they're very clean looking portraits. And then you've used blue, a kind of royal blue or navy blue. It's very thick. It looks like almost like lipstick or oil paint.
The text portion is made with a wax pastel, and I pushed it really hard to get them vibrant enough so you could read the text as best as possible. And there's 3 different tones of blue, just depending on what kind of skin tone there is on the viewer. And then the stripe of color across the eyes is something that was kind of important to me. That's the first stroke of paint that I do. I reflect, when I start this process, I reflect on the story and the conversation that I had with these people. And I choose that color based on my time with them and kind of how it felt. And then I build up the layers of paint from there.
So the stripe of wash goes on
first.
Before everything?
Yep. Yes. I have like a very basic pencil sketch of their face, and then I put the stripe right over the eyes to begin.
So you're very definitive with the words. They're all caps. It's not a font, you know, it's handwritten, but they're things like, I can never tell you why your mom and I broke up. It's okay to disappear into the void for a bit to find yourself again. You live on in the ways you taught me to love. I've always been good enough. I'm so thankful to know you guys and for this great time. Kind of positive things, but left unsaid in some cases.
Yeah, in some cases they are a little heavier content. The conversations themselves range from 15 minutes to an hour. Some of these people were completely strangers to me, so I've cried on public benches with strangers talking about these things. Some of them are to people who have passed on, and some of them are to people who are still living. And I'm just really interested in kind of why we don't say things and the reasons behind that. And so during our conversations, we kind of talked about that aspect of it. Like, why do you feel you haven't been able to say this? You know, what are the reasons for that? And I just got to hear a lot of relational dynamics.
But you had to boil it down to one sentence.
We did, yeah. So, like, at the end of our conversation, that's basically what I would ask them. I would say, okay, if we can boil this down to a short phrase or a few words, what would it be? And this is what we came up with together. Like, I let my collaborators, as I call them, kind of tell me what they would, like, want it to be concisely. And then from there, everyone was on board from the beginning for their words to be on someone else's face, because they knew that it's important to include the images so that we can represent a diverse group of people, but also, like, be able to get their story across. So there were a few layers of consent with the text being on someone else's face. I kind of just decided them, mixed them up, and then I would send everyone a message and say, here's the words that I'm thinking of going to go on your face. Are you okay with this before I move forward?
Okay.
So I made sure with everyone, like, there were layers of consent to that practice.
Is this the end of this project, or can you see yourself doing an iteration of this after university?
I'm definitely going to continue with this, probably in editions of 20. I've also made a zine for it, and it's called Volume 1. And so to continue on, I'll do sections of 20, and then I'm also interested in opening, like, doing it in a public space, like setting up at a park somewhere, and just seeing who happens to come up and encounter the situation, and do it that way as well. I think that would be really interesting, to just have people randomly come to me instead of me reaching out to people for this.
And then you're going to get a master's in social work.
I'm going to get a master's in education at the secondary level. I want to teach art at the secondary level to middle schoolers. I want to teach through a trauma-informed mental health lens. I think art is a perfect way to teach kids how to cope with things, how to be in community with one another, and that's really where I'm going with all of this. And I think this is a great side thing for me to be doing during that, because it is about community. It is about these overarching themes of connection, what we do and don't say, grief, loss, love, everything.
Great. Thank you very much, Ash.
Thank you so much for your time.
Just say your name and how you spell it.
Madeline Blackham, MadelineBlackham. And this is my series, Little Zodiac. It works with defining what our fears are as humans, as a species, and kind of questioning how we separate ourselves from our fear and questioning the value of that fear. For example, I have The Reaper, the Sower, which talks about our issues with death.
So these are three acrylic paintings on canvas. What the first one's of a vulture, the second's a wolf and a sheep, and the third one is a sort of naked human with their back to us. So tell us about the vulture.
The vulture is a stand-in for a reaper, sort of in a natural environment. They consume the energy of the dead and redistribute it as a life force across the ecosystem. And a lot of people fear death, and we spend a lot of time running away from it, fighting off the effects of aging. Even after death, we tend to flood our loved ones with chemicals and seal them in a box to delay decomposition. And so I wanted to emphasize death as something that we fear, but should question why we fear it and if that fear is valid. And what do our reactions to that fear end up doing to us that are actually way more scary than death itself?
So you've painted the vulture sort of, its wing is like a cloak almost. All the feathers are drooping. There's it looks like the vulture's holding a big asparagus with two blades on it, but that's the reaper's reaping machine?
Yeah, I wanted it to be a little bit more like a green stick for the staff of the scythe, just to kind of like emphasize that fertility and renewal that comes with death, like the idea that it's regrowing as it goes along.
And the bird is sort of standing there on a red soil, bright red background, in a cactus field with a sort of a dappled purple and gold sky, like almost like dawn or dusk.
Yeah, I work a lot with vibrant colors when I'm working with horror, just to emphasize like that idea of beautifying and really trying to draw the viewer to contemplate it. I went with the red soil because I was referencing the deserts in Utah, but I definitely skewed more towards a more crimson color than that orange because I started to see it as, especially with the shadows, as the blood of the plants sort of seeping out and refertilizing the soil, the lifeblood. Yeah, and other than that, I enjoy psychedelic colors with my horror.
So the eye of the bird is very worked on. It's very textured. It's sort of almost like the eye of a hurricane. And the eye of the wolf in the next one, and the sheep, similar. There's a lot of energy around the eyes. But you've put the sheep up top, and you've actually kind of glued sheepskin on.
Yes.
So you could kind of comb it if you were walking by.
I used sheep's wool. It's actually a Leicester Dorset cross, which is a British sheep breed. And wolves in the UK were actually hunted out by the 17th century due to deforestation and government-mandated bounty hunting. With this painting, I was working on our idea of the natural world of this carnivorous predator as a pest in our minds that comes after our livestock, which really reveals the wolf's role as someone who's had their food and their home stripped away from them. So, of course, they go and prey on our domestic animals. When I originally worked on this, I had kind of envisioned the second reveal to be the sheep as the liar, the taker, while you initially assume it's the wolf that it's revealed to be the sheep. And as I was working on it, I realized the sheep wasn't a sheep in itself, but a symbol for the domestication and the destruction of the natural world.
So the wolf is kind of curled around almost 360, yeah. But the sheep's head is coming out of the wolf's belly.
Yeah, I wanted to make the sheep a light source. Also, with the rest of the series, I have it framed so that the vulture faces the center, which is the sheep, and the human is turned away from it. With the wolf, just compositionally, I wanted to have it surrounding the sheep so it's not turned either way.
Mm-hmm. And then the final one is just a very, looks like a very skinny woman with lots of ribs in pale blue with her back, scratching with her back to the viewer on a very built-up kind of inky black acrylic background. It's very thick.
Yes.
Brush strokes.
So this one is called The Lover, the Destroyer. It loops humans into the Zodiac as an animal and as the sole creature to alienate itself from the rest of Zodiac and from nature and from its sense of mortality and from the consequences of our own mistakes. So it's turned away from the rest of the Zodiac, which represents all of those things. And the texture that sort of lifted the rest of the creatures off of the canvas eludes the human and creates a frame that pushes it further away from us and from the rest of the Zodiac. The human itself, I chose to make blue and to have it turned away to sort of take away any racially or sexually identifying characteristics, any one idea of humanity, and just have it be a body. Ourselves are our own vulnerable, soft animal bodies. Just enforcing that idea of alienation from the rest of it, but at the same time, like, belonging. It mm-hmm. was originally part of all of this.
Are you into the Zodiac?
A little bit. Originally, I was going to call this Pantheon, but I think what I'm really into is just a group of creatures that each have their own symbolism. So that could be the Zodiac or the Pantheon or any kind of mythology, I guess.
Did you check your horoscope?
Not regularly. My partner would love me to do that, but yeah.
What are you going to do with a degree in art?
Oh, man. I am still figuring that out. I would love to get into galleries like this more. Eventually, I may go back for my master's and work on museum curation. But for now, I think I would like to just keep pursuing horror art and see where
pursuing what?
Horror art. Horror art, surrealism. I think that my genre is very much in between surrealism and horror. So yeah, I'll just keep pursuing that and see where my connections in the art community get me for now.
Do you need to get a job?
Yeah, I'm going to work in childcare for regular work, so yeah.
Great. Thank you very much, Madeline.
Thank you. It was great to meet you.
Just say your name and how you spell it.
Alejandro Ponce, AlejandroPonce.
Okay, and what's the name of your video installation?
True Love Part 1.
We saw a woman with a face mask dancing around in a sort of empty concrete room. Tell us a bit more.
So, True Love Part 1 is actually the first part to a four-part video installation series I really want to do. All really kind of exploring and revolting around the belief system coined by Elizabeth Brake, known as amatonormativity. And that belief system is the idea that every person in the world wants and, most importantly, benefits from the same kind of relationship, that being a long-term, role-centric, monogamous relationship. I think, I hope anyone who learns about that knows that that's false. Relationships don't work that way. So that is what true love is. It is a revolt against the status quo of how relationships work, and bringing up the topic and the ideas that you do not need to conform to a specific relationship like type to be happy. And most importantly, you need to take that step forward or that step back to be happy with yourself and the people around you.
How did you learn all that?
Funny enough, actually, originally when I was making True Love, I didn't really know why I was making it. It was kind of that gut sensation that this was a piece I really needed to work on. And I couldn't explain it for the longest time. And actually, when I had my first critique and someone asked me that, I had to just straight up say, I really don't know. I wish I had an answer for you. I don't know, but I know I needed to make this piece. And at that same critique, my cohort by the name of George, they brought up the fact, they brought this term up, amatonormativity. And I looked it up and I realized this is what I've been trying to talk about. This idea of conforming to this relationship, I want to talk about the revolt against this. Because throughout my life, I had been told I need to act a very specific way in relationships as a cis Hispanic man. And I grew up with a father who was very anti-establishment, and he was very much, you do not need to conform to the way the world tells you. And I wanted to explore this topic. So, yeah.
The characters are walking around. So the woman was in like a tank top, but she has one of those sort of molded white masks. It's not quite the anonymous one or the theater one. It's similar. And the guy has something on his head. It looks like a giant baseball glove or a bunch of bananas. And now they're out walking on the Tilikum crossing.
So I really love the idea for my short films. I really want to take the idea of the human face out of it so people are able to imprint their face onto each person. So for a lot of my films going forward, I very much want the faces to be obscured. And with that, that goes into like mask construction, what each mask represents and stuff like that. And for Void's mask, we can actually see it right now, the stark white mask that you're seeing with the play. This mask very much calls back to that Void has lost her artistic inspiration. She has lost her will to evolve. And she is this blank canvas that can have anything happen to her. And the second mask we see, which you saw earlier, which was a half-faced leather face mask, is very much calling to that this is her point where she is able to evolve. She is now having the ability and the confidence to evolve as a person and be an artist. And the male's mask, his character's name is Spiral. His mask is a little more complex in its design and a lot more abstract, but when you look straight forward, what you're supposed to see is that of a black hole. Spiral is a hurt person. He is a person with problems that he is not fixing, and because of that, his being, his essence, is being sucked into this portal that he cannot control. And in doing so, he is not only damaging himself, but also the relationships around him.
So we're actually in the middle of the movie now because we watched the end first. You presented it so beautifully. It's on this kind of, it looks like a thick white canvas. The video is shooting, you can see it on both sides, and it's on this welded steel kind of sawhorse. Did you make that?
I did make that, yeah. That was actually my first ever time welding.
Why didn't you just buy a little tripod from Amazon?
There's a lot of reasons to that. First off, I wanted to actually get into welding because I really have ideas for sculptural pieces I want to do. So I wanted to weld something. But I also really wanted to create a piece that just felt sturdy. I wanted the, since the film is discussing and tackling such a large and stagnant belief system as amateur normativity, I really wanted the thing it was projected on to feel that way. I wanted you to look at it and feel like if you pushed it, it would not tip over. So that's why I chose very hard, rigid surfaces, that being wood and welded steel.
So at the end of term, students have to take their work home. What are you going to do with your steel sawhorse?
With the sawhorse, I might weld it down to, because when all four films are presented, they're going to be presented on an entirely different like installation. So for the board of wood, I'm going to keep because I can definitely use it for other projects. The sawhorse, I'm planning on cutting apart and welding down and then reusing it for other projects. I'm actually going to use those black poles that are sticking up. I have an idea for what those are going to be used for. And I really like that idea because this is one of my first pieces that is actually being able to be deconstructed and stuff like that. So I really want to try to reuse as much of the material as possible.
Has doing this work given you ideas for a career?
Oh, most definitely. I really want to tell stories with my art. I have always loved telling stories, especially stories that very deal in the emotion of bittersweet, where you go on this long, arduous journey with no hope in sight, and then the ending is very hopeful and happy. And I don't really know if that emotion has a word to it, but that feeling of accomplishment and acknowledgement of the pain you've gone through and looking back at where you've come from is very much what I want to do with my stories. And I really just would love to tell stories through my art. And most importantly, I don't think stories need to be confined to one specific medium. Like, we oftentimes see stories told in book form or movie form. And I very much love the idea of telling a story through sculptural pieces or even video installations where it's just colors and shapes. So I very much want to not restrict myself to one medium, which is why I just call myself a storyteller, not like a video installation artist or a sculptural artist.
Thank you very much, Alejandro.
Thank you. Thank you.
So just say your name and how you spell it.
Laura Glazer, G-L-A-Z-E-R.
And what's the name of your piece in this MFA project?
My project is called Let the City Serve Knowledge, based off of the Portland State University motto. Let me double check. I actually called it PSU motto. Let knowledge serve the city.
Mono?
Motto.
Motto, okay. We can do that again.
Okay.
So what's the name of your piece that is part of your MFA project?
There are actually two pieces. The first one is called PSU motto, Let knowledge serve the city. And the second piece, for which there's a free poster, is called Alternate Motto, Let the City Serve Knowledge.
Okay, so the first one is a photo of the PSU slogan, which is in gold letters on the skywalk downtown. And the second one is a similar photo, but you change the words around. But it's a huge pile of color photocopies, I think, and people can take one.
That's right. When I first moved here in 2016, I saw the sign with PSU's motto on the sky bridge over Southwest Broadway, and I was so inspired by it. And I wondered, as a new resident, what knowledge will I use to serve my new home? Now, in 2023, as I'm graduating from the Art and Social Practice program, I'm rethinking that motto and proposing an alternate second motto that embraces the place-based learning that we do within our program and in the institution here, that it acknowledges the ways in which this place educates us. Mm-hmm. So I created a mock-up of a sign that would go on the other side of the sky bridge that has the alternate motto on it, so that pedestrians walking down Broadway see that, and motorists and pedestrians driving or walking up Broadway see the original motto, and they play off of each other.
Are you going to get up there with your gold letters and stick it on?
I don't think so. I think I'd like to do something a bit more permanent, and I have hopes for another iteration of the project or another phase in which I work with PSU students, staff, instructors, the community at large, to translate both mottos into whatever native language that person speaks, and then perhaps do a projection of those translations onto the sky bridge, so that it's not just the English motto. It embraces all of the ways of saying the motto and living the motto.
Mm-hmm. I would think social practice it's ideal in Portland, because if you want to make things difficult for yourself, just try and get the city to do anything, because you're going to have to go through a lot of stakeholders.
I think there are interventions that are possible on micro levels that can be embraced by the community in which they happen, and don't have to go to that level of someone approving it. I think change can be small and localized, to as small as your next door neighbor to perhaps the apartment building down the block. So my focus stays there, and then I can build an audience around the project, and then eventually when all those stakeholders organically find out about the project, then maybe we work together and the city is already interested. I don't have to go straight to the city and ask for permission. I can grow the project without them.
Mm-hmm. The piece is fairly minimal. It's a pile of posters and people just take it. Is it just the tip of the iceberg of all the work you've put into this?
Absolutely.
Or have you done like 20 other things?
Another part of this exhibit is the row of bookshelves on that wall. And I've called that knowledge gained from the city, and its publications I've published as part of my projects that are examples of the ways in which the city has taught things to me. So it includes a project I did with the King School Museum of Contemporary Art in Northeast Portland, where I documented art exhibits on classroom doors for Black History Month and interviewed people who were part of those exhibits, documented it, and published a book. I interviewed the provost of Portland State University and talked to her about this idea of an alternate motto and what the motto means in general. So there are examples of how I have lived this project during my time here.
When you first came, what kind of knowledge did you think you were going to offer to the city? Some kind of art?
I come from upstate New York, where I had been doing a radio show since 2001, a weekly show on public and community radio stations.
What's it called?
It was called Hello Pretty City, and I did it for 17 years, every week. And I thought, I'll be bringing the spirit that I create that show with into this new context, this new city, and responding to the city through whatever medium it needs. When I lived in Albany, it was a radio show. That was my way of connecting with that place and the people in that place. And when I came here, I felt really open to what the city was showing me, and that I would create something from that.
Did you come here to do the art degree?
No, I had no idea what an MFA or a grad school was. I traveled here I moved here because my boyfriend got a job here. And I came with him after living in upstate New York for 20 years. I met some people through Instagram who were graduates of the program and found out that the work I'd been doing for the past 20 years was a form of socially engaged art. And that's when I applied to the program to formalize my practice more.
Which is better, Portland or Albany?
They're both awesome. They both are their own places. And something served me and inspired me, each in their own way. I love both places. I actually like most places.
Which is better, Troy or West Lynn?
I've actually never been to West Lynn. I love Troy, and I assume I'd find something to love in West Lynn. I guess I go into places pretty wide-eyed and open to the history, the current state, and also the people who live there.
What do you think having the MFA in art will do for your career?
It helps me understand my process and my natural inclination to participate and make with other people. And I can talk about it more clearly and perhaps help other people do the same.
Thanks for talking to KBOO, Laura.
You're welcome.
What's your name and how do you spell it?
Kiara, K-I-A-R-A. Walls, W-A-L-L-S.
And what's the name of this work?
The Black Box.
So it looks like you constructed a kind of a plywood box with a large opening. And inside, there's one window, but inside there's like pink velour banquettes and a pink carpet and swagged pink ceiling and little plastic flowers. And then there are these wooden etched boards, cards, and they say, look at one of the reflections and then record your response into a recorder.
Yeah, so essentially the focus of this iteration of the Black Box project is around sovereignty, and more so specifically Black sovereignty and what that looks like. So essentially when the first iteration of the box began back in 2018, it was exploring the question around what would reparations look like today. And from there, there were different iterations in different locations as far as like Dallas, Texas, Portland, Oregon, where we're at right now. And from the responses, the community responses around that question, I've learned that it is healing. Healing is the question to what would reparations look like today. But then I'm also wondering, well, what happens after healing? Sovereignty, which is having agency or autonomy over your life. So what I'm really interested in is asking questions around sovereignty and asking this in a space where people can add to the conversation for their own experience. So just as an example, I can read one of the questions right here. How does personal sovereignty intersect with your sense of identity and self-expression? So if people feel comfortable answering the question, there's also a tape recorder present where they can add the recording of whatever question they're interested in responding to.
So you're gathering ideas. What do you do with the ideas?
So the ideas that were gathered in the beginning of the project inform the inside of the box for the next build. And for this box specifically, I'm actually not too sure what I'm going to do with the responses. And I'm more so looking at this as more of research, because when I first came to the idea of sovereignty, I didn't really know too much about it. And I feel like the way that I learn is to learn from other people and through conversation. So I really wanted to use this as an opportunity to gain a better understanding from how this idea of sovereignty correlates with people's identity and their life. And I think from that, it just will help me have a better understanding of what this can actually look like and what shape this can take form in, so that it's also a way for other people to learn about it as well.
Do people actually talk about reparations though, and like getting money?
Yeah, so originally when I first asked the question, I would say that people thought, I don't know, people would say like, oh, it could be like a paycheck or it has like monetary value. But I feel like as people added to the conversation more, it looked more as like, oh, well, there's healthcare centers in neighborhoods, or there's credit repair, or there's scholarships. And it really helped me better understand that reparations is more of a spectrum, because it's not a definitive answer. And I think also with just whatever is in the box, it helps guide the person to understand that it is a spectrum, like it can be applied to different things. So with sovereignty and reparations, I definitely feel like there's a range and there's no one answer. It's more so an invitation to explore more what it could look like for you. And that also just adds to this holistic meaning of the theme itself.
What's gonna be in the next box?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure yet. I mean, I think it really just depends on
yeah, what people are saying. And I think it may even be just another situation how it is now to just gain more understanding around that. Because I also don't want to create something that's only based on just like a smaller group of responses. I really like the idea of going to different locations and getting more of like a communal answer. And then something can come out of the work. So right now, it's probably going to be sovereignty and just asking more questions around that.
What are you going to do with your MFA?
So, I actually just got a position as the facilitation and learning manager at Open School, which is a really great alternative school for underserved youth within Portland. And I'm going to be doing a lot of conversations or facilitating conversations and learning around healing and self-care. And I really think my MFA helps me inform what that facilitation looks like, because I've really developed my practice to where I've used conversation as a tool to connect with people and to foster learning and creativity. So that's how I'm looking to use what I've learned.
Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Kiara.
No problem. Thank you for having me.